Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This morning we're going to talk about corruption, and there is no better person to do so with, and that is Paul Hoffman SC, who practiced law at the sidebar from 1975 to 1980 and the Cape Bar from 1980 to 2006. He took silk in 1995 and acted on the Cape Bench at the invitation of three successive judges president. Retiring from the bar, he was co-founder in 2009 of Accountability Now, promoting constitutionalism. He's best known for his work on the irregularities in the arms deals, on the unconstitutionality of the Hawks, and on the Bread Cartel case, in which a general class action was developed by the courts. The story of the Glenister litigation, which has much to do with said unconstitutionality of the Hawks and more, is a story of the litigation as experienced by the lawyers involved, and is to be found as a compilation, yes, of essays, of chapters, in a book, free ebook, what's more, called Under the Swinging Arch, and Google will take you right to it. He's also the author of many articles and two books, Confronting the Corrupt and Countering the Corrupt. And hopefully we will be able to encourage him to write Conquering the Corrupt. But that's for the future. And now we're going to talk about it. Paul Hoffman, welcome to Chai FM again.
Thank you for that very fulsome introduction, and a pleasure to be on the air with you, Sarah.
Corruption, South Africa can probably offer the most colorful varieties and experiences of corruption of probably any country in the world right now. But you say now is a particular time for anti-corruption activists to take the fight further, and there are several advantages that we have because of it. What are our advantages? Because right now I don't think anyone thinks that anything to do with corruption has the word of advantageous in the same sentence.
Yes, I am afraid that our venture into constitutional democracy has come with quite a heavy price in terms of the hijacking of the state. It's called state capture. It's a form of corruption. But other forms of corruption are pretty endemic in South Africa, in Africa, and indeed in the world at large at this stage. And South Africa does not feature well on the indices that are kept by Transparency International and other institutions. And in fact, our score is worse than it was at the height of state capture, when the Zuma and the Guptas were turning South Africa into their plaything. So in order to deal with corruption, as we must now if we want to survive as a constitutional democracy, we need to put our civil society big girl Brooks on and get involved in standing up to those who think that going into politics is an excuse for getting rich quickly, rather than an opportunity to serve the people that elect you. And I'm afraid all too often in politics in South Africa, especially at local and provincial level, entry into politics is just an excuse to steal from the public. And when you steal from the public, it is the poor who suffer the most. And that means that the poor need to bring that into their consciousness, which is the task of the leaders of civil society, so that politicians know that the people of South Africa have got to the point where we've really had enough of corruption and something drastic needs to be done. And the Chief Justice has admonished us that if we don't do something, that we won't have a country worth living in. That's how seriously he takes it. That is the recently retired Chief Justice, not the Chief Justice who's sitting this week in in the Judicial Service Commission, helping with the task of finding more talent for the bench.
Right. That raises actually two questions, perhaps, before we look at the seven advantages that we have in dealing with corruption. The first is why is it worsened at the height of Jacob Zuma's tenure, is the one. And do we have any sense of the new, our new judge president, Mandisa Maya?
Yes, I think that in the era of Jacob Zuma, he has made it clear subsequently with the formation of MK that he doesn't like the South African constitution, thinks that if he was the dictator of South Africa, he'd have everything fixed in 6 months flat. And MK has just last week brought out a constitution for MK in which their idea is to turn South Africa back into a parliamentary sovereignty instead of being the constitutional state it is at the moment. And it's important that we understand what this means. In a parliamentary sovereignty, the members of parliament call the shots and everybody else obeys them. In a constitutional democracy under the rule of law, which is what we have in South Africa, at least on paper, the constitution calls the shots, and anybody who paints outside the lines of the constitution is acting in a manner that is invalid and can be attacked in court, and the courts have the power to declare conduct or laws, new laws, that are not in line with constitutional tenets, principles, and precepts, and have those laws struck down as unconstitutional and give instructions to the politicians to fix up the mess and do so within a set period so that the mess does not remain for too long. And we've seen it in various aspects of policy decisions that have been made. Think of the litigation around HIV/AIDS and making medicines available to mothers of children who are born with HIV/AIDS. That policy change from the Mbeki denialism to the situation that we have today, where a good percentage of our HIV/AIDS sufferers are on medication that saves their lives, that would not have been able to occur at all in a parliamentary sovereignty, because the denialism would have trumped the efforts to overcome it. Whereas in our constitutional democracy, the court was quite happy to say, listen, your policy is not up to constitutional standards, and you have to change what you are doing in relation to the plague that was HIV/AIDS, and that has since faded from consciousness because it is no longer a killer.
In fact, South Africans, perhaps we forget that we have dreadful experience of a extreme form of parliamentary sovereignty, and that was the apartheid government.
Yes. Yes, what the politician said went. That was it. They were able to enforce a system that had nothing to do with human rights, whereas now Chapter 2 of our Constitution guarantees a wide variety of very expensive human rights to everybody in South Africa, and the state is obliged to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill all of the rights guaranteed to all in the Bill of Rights, which is Chapter 2 of the Constitution. And that is what we used in the Glenister litigation in order to paint government into a corner on anti-corruption measures. We managed to persuade the court to regard corruption as an insult to the Bill of Rights, as a threat to the ability of the state to roll out the rights in the Bill of Rights. It costs a lot of money to give healthcare and education and housing to everybody, And you can't do it if the money is being diverted into the pockets of those involved in corrupt activities, whether it's state capture or tenderpreneurism or just straight bribery and corruption, the old-fashioned kind. All of those activities divert public money into illicit financial flows into the pockets of those involved in corruption. So the court bought that argument and said that in South Africa, corruption is a human rights issue. And because the state is obliged to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill human rights, it is up to the state to put in place machinery that is able to deal with corruption efficiently and effectively. Well, that hasn't happened on Jacob Zuma's watch, and it hasn't happened on Cyril Ramaphosa's watch. But what we have at this stage, pending in Parliament, is a private member's bill. In fact, there are two bills. The one establishes a Chapter 9 anti-corruption commission, and the other enables and empowers it to carry out the functions of preventing, combating, investigating, and prosecuting serious corruption wherever it occurs. And in order to properly comply with what was found in the Glenister litigation, which is the subject matter of that book you mentioned, the e-book that is accessible by putting "Under the Swinging Arch" into a Google search. Sorry, that's an advert, but I'm not getting any money from the advert.
Brought to you by, yes.
Anyway, the point is this, that the human rights aspects of the Constitution have been used by the court as a basis for saying that an anti-corruption unit should look like something that can actually work. And in order to get that right, the main thing is that the anti-corruption entity ought to be free of executive control. And that is said both in Glenister 2 and in the follow-up case in 2014. You cannot have it in the executive.
Okay. So that essentially is what Section 9 institutions are meant to be about.
Yeah, Chapter 9 institutions.
Chapter 9. Parliament.
Chapter 9 institutions, we're talking about things like the Public Protector, the Human Rights Commission, the Independent Electoral Commission, Auditor General. Those institutions do not have a reporting line to the cabinet. They report directly to Parliament, and the Constitution actually entrenches their independence. There are provisions in Chapter 9 that admonish everybody else to treat the Chapter 9 institutions as royal game. And that was why it was so difficult to get rid of Busisiwe Mkhwebane. She was royal game, and it took a lot of effort to get her impeached or...
Surely, I mean, I remember just my own sense of my heart sinking to my boots when Jacob Zuma caused the Scorpions to be shut down. But that is probably as briefly and as closely as we've come to what you envisage. Am I right?
The closure of the Scorpions was step one in the state capture project of the Jacob Zuma presidency. Zuma wanted them closed down because they were making his life miserable. Remember... Mm. Busi Pikole was prepared to charge Zuma. He, in fact, succeeded in getting Zuma's financial advisor, Mr. Shavir Sheikh, convicted of corruption and sentenced to 15 years in jail for corrupting Jacob Zuma. And the NPA is still trying to get that right on the dropping the second shoe, getting Zuma convicted. Right. On exactly the same charges, relating to exactly the same facts, for which proof beyond a reasonable doubt was adduced to the satisfaction of the High Court, the Supreme Court of Appeal, and the Constitutional Court in the case of Shabir Sheikh. So Sheikh went down in 2005, and Zuma will face trial in 2025. But who said that justice was a fast-moving process?
Maybe perhaps in our lifetimes, moving on. Just having consideration of what you see as our advantages, a new government which supports constitutionalism and the rule of law, a free media sector which, whatever may be leveled at our media sector, the investigative element of it, and I say that broadly, has been magnificent. An independent judiciary which has shown its independence. Big businesses' participation through the crime and corruption work stream set up last year by the Cabinet. The Glenister cases, as you've discussed, and academic institutions which support the truth, certainly in this regard. And probably for me, the most impressive, and I speak with a certain amount of, partiality, is that South Africa's always had a very vibrant and well-organized civil society. And I think from a point of view of trying to do any nefarious things like cut down on speech or go ahead with corruption or whatever it is that might be, South Africa would have been a very much worse off place and much worse off if that civil society, which has a solid history in South Africa, hadn't existed. What is the possible stumbling block in the way of the private members' draft legislation to establishing a Chapter 9 institution, as you've enunciated?
Yes, look, I'm not saying that the Chapter 9 institution is the only or even the best solution to the problem. It's just the best one that I've been able to devise, and I've spent quite a few years working on the problem. The difficulty has been that I would say it's probably Cabinet more than the ANC as such has an aversion to relinquishing control of the levers of power that are used by those involved in anti-corruption work. You know, the National Democratic Revolution, about which Anthea Jeffrey writes so eloquently, envisages hegemonic control of all the levers of power in society. And certainly, anti-corruption machinery is a very important lever of power because it keeps those with access to power in positions of responsibility and power on the straight and narrow. And if you don't have it, then what you have in its place is a multitude of sins, including state capture, possibility of the state failing altogether, and the ongoing tenderpreneurism that you see in the hospitals in Gauteng, and all manner of malfeasance that ought to be checked and isn't checked, because the Department of Justice is currently in charge of the anti-corruption machinery of state. In fact, the Minister of Justice has final responsibility over the whole of the NPA. The Minister of Justice has to concur in the policies that the National Director of Public Prosecutions and the DPPs, pensioned provinces, devise. The Director General of the Department of Justice, he's not even part of the NPA, happens to be the accounting officer of the NPA. So when you want new pencils or paper for the photostat machine and you're in the NPA, you have to get the DG to sign off on that. Now, all of those features tell you loud and clear that although the Constitution says laws should be passed that ensure that the NPA functions without fear, favor, or prejudice, there is no way that you can describe the NPA as an independent institution of the kind that has been ordered up in binding terms by the highest court of the land. Not once, but twice. Initially, in 2011, when Glenister II ended in that magnificent judgment of Deputy Chief Justice Moseneke and Justice Edwin Cameron, they wrote a joint judgment for the majority in that case. And relying on the human rights aspect, which we've discussed already, and on the international obligations of South Africa to keep in place anti-corruption machinery that would make them compliant with the United Nations Convention Against Corruption and similar instruments at AU level and in SADC. All of those obligations are not being properly respected by the South African government because it insists that Hawks investigating and NPA prosecuting is the way to do things. They've now recently, in the course of this year, they've brought about an amendment creating the what they call permanent, and it's no more permanent than the Hawks than the Scorpions were, the investigating directorate against corruption, which is simply a unit within the NPA, which is what the Scorpions were, which is given the job of both investigating and prosecuting serious corruption. And the unconstitutionality of that, having been through what the situation of the NPA is, you can't create an independent institution within the NPA when the NPA itself suffers from all of these disabilities, with the minister having final responsibility, the minister concurring in policy, and the DG of the Justice Department being your accounting officer. So what we have at the moment is the opportunity to generate the political will necessary to bring about reform. And this is a byproduct of all of the things you mentioned, the vibrancy of civil society, the faith-based organizations that always try to keep politicians on the straight and narrow, the academics who are constantly chiseling away at what needs to be done. Even the CSIR has done a magnificent study on the ins and outs of corruption in South Africa. And organizations like the Institute for Security Studies, ALTA, Helen Suzman Foundation, actually involved in the litigation, the Freedom Under Law, all Corruption Watch, all of them are out there making a noise, bringing the urgency of the situation onto the boil. And then elements in the GNU, and funnily enough, the first political party to come around to the idea of a Chapter 9 institution was the IFP. Mm-hmm. And the IFP has been punting the idea since 2019. Mm-hmm. In 2020, the ANC's National Executive Committee, which is its highest decision-making body between conferences, actually passed a resolution calling on Cabinet to urgently put in place a permanent, independent, specialized anti-corruption body. And Cabinet ignored that resolution, which is very unusual. But some people say, I don't know if it's true, that it wasn't seriously made. It was done in order to deal with a meme going around saying FTSAC ANC, and they thought that they would slow that down if they could be seen standing up against the corrupt. Thing is, it is a resolution of it's in the public domain. I've written about it a lot, and the ANC has just failed on pretending that the NEC did not pass that resolution back in 2020. But at this stage, what we have on the one side of the scale is a palpably unconstitutional body called the Investigating Directorate Against Corruption. And on the other side of the scale, coming out of the same GNU now, because the IDAC, the Investigating Directorate, was one of the last things that was done before the GNU was formed. It was really done in May this year before the election that brought the GNU into office. But now with the GNU in place, interesting things are going to happen when Glynis Breytenbach, wearing her former Shadow Minister of Justice hat, promotes these two private members' bills which are brought in her name to set up and enable the Chapter 9 Anti-Corruption Commission. And it's really on that vote that civil society, people who are listening to this broadcast, should be putting pressure on politicians of all stripes, of all parties, whether in the GNU or in the opposition, to vote for the bills, so that we can put in place constitutionally compliant anti-corruption machinery of state. The original judgment, which sets out the criteria, is very clear, crystal clear. You need to have a specialized body of trained operatives who are in an independent environment in which they are free of executive interference or control, that are properly resourced in guaranteed fashion so that they don't run out of petrol when they're on the trail of the corrupt, and which enjoy secure tenure of office. Now, IDAC, the investigating directorate, can be closed down by a simple majority in Parliament. Exactly the same thing as happened to the Scorpions back in 2009. We are not learning from the mistakes of history if we think that IDAC fits the bill. The former Minister of Justice, now Minister of International Relations, Ronald Lamola, he tried to paint lipstick onto the IDAC and described it as STIRS compliant, in other words, specialized, trained, independent, resourced, and secure. That the STIRS acronym is the shorthand way of describing what I've just described, which is the criteria, the main criteria for your anti-corruption machinery. So I think if ordinary people bring it into their consciousness and into the consciousness of the politicians that they are able to get to, we will in fact get to the point where everybody agrees that we cannot carry on like we are. We are staring failed statehood down the barrel. We know that we cannot attract fresh investment, whether from South African investors or direct foreign investment. We cannot get that to happen while corruption is at the levels at which it is in South Africa at the moment. So until we show signs of being serious about dealing with corruption, we are not going to be able to create the jobs that flow from the new investment that is needed to give the economy the kickstart that it needs badly. So it's all very well having these lovely work streams that the government is putting in place with private business, but it's not helpful when you are keeping the taps of corruption wide open and so much in the lifeblood of the country is just flowing away.
You've answered the last question that I was going to ask for your comment on, and that was exactly that. There is a positive mood in the business sector, whether entirely justified, I'm not sure. But the very fact of the establishment of a genuinely independent corruption-busting entity would increase our attractiveness as a destination for investment, because it sends out a whole lot of all the right messages. And I think what I'll have to do I'll get you back when you've conquered corruption, but I think we'll start with what happens when the two private members' bills come through. Paul, thank you very, very much for joining us.
No, it's my pleasure. I must say the time that we've had together has flown by. I thought we were about halfway, and then I looked and I saw that we were a lot further.
Sadly.
Yeah.
But we will.
As I say, I put in now the third punt for Under the Swinging Arch. Anybody who's got interested in this conversation can for free. And start with Appendix 6. That's where you start reading. It's right in the back of the book. It's like an Agatha Christie novel. If you read Appendix 6 first, you get an overview of what you can derive from reading.
And remember, folks, it's free. Paul, thank you. We'll be in touch.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.